This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour, our week in review program. This morning there was a very interesting Trumpet Daily program Stephen Fleury brought to us about Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor, and how this man works to shape the narrative of events reported in the press. I would really encourage you to listen to that program. It gives a lot of good insight into why the news you find on so many mainstream sources is so poor, how it doesn't really give you insight. It really is manufactured to convey a certain impression that is approved by the Obama administration. I hope you agree with me that the need for the trumpet is stronger than ever. There are many extremely important events happening in the world that are ignored or that are misreported. People in the news don't recognize the significance of what is happening. We aim to give you real insight and understanding. We aim to give you a quality perspective of events of the week. And I believe that regular trumpet readers and listeners to trumpet radio have a very good grasp of what really is important. Here we have our panel of trumpet writers to discuss the important events of this past week. And as I introduce them, they'll give us a teaser of what they're going to be covering for us today. Here we have in the studio, Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you. I'll be talking a little about Japan asserting that they have the right to develop the most devastating weapons that mankind has ever devised.
We also have Andrew Miller.
Thank you. We'll be talking a lot about some devastating wildfires up in Alberta, Canada, and also about some May Day protests in London, England.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. Is Croatia turning into a fascist state? The nation's new government looks on the country's Nazi-aligned World War II leadership as their founding fathers.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello, good to be here. Today I'll be talking about the often overlooked Persian Gulf nation of Oman and its growing relationship with Iran, and we will look at where this relationship might lead.
All right, we're going to start by talking about Europe and a leaked report out of Germany that shows plans and a desire for a common European army. So we're going to pitch this right over to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so a report has leaked from Germany. It's been published, or details have been published in the Süddeutsche Zeitung and the Financial Times, about a German desire to set up some vital European pieces of cooperation on the way to a European army. So according to this report, they want to create a European kind of operation center, a joint civil military headquarters for the European Union. They want to have a council of defense ministers. So a much greater militarization of the European Union, and to start to put in military command structures in there. And then they've also talked about how they want to examine the use of all possibilities available among EU treaties to establish this cooperation. So if there's just a smaller group of nations that want to move forward with that, they want to do that and find ways to move forward with this without individual nations such as Britain blocking the project.
So this is obviously something that we've had several conversations about, how Germany has been pushing to get some kind of European militarization integration. How is this different, or how does this mark a step forward in those plans?
Well, the main thing we've talked about so far is kind of this bottom-up approach to military cooperation. So they've been working with kind of one nation at a time. So Germany has been working with the Netherlands very closely. They've absorbed the major part of the Dutch army's kind of offensive capabilities right inside the German army. They're making steps towards putting together a multinational panzer division. Now, it looks like at the same time, they're going to start coming at this from the other direction. And so they're going to look at putting in place the command structure now that you would need to have a European army. And you know, sooner or later, they are going to need this if they want a European army. So I think it shows that they think they're making a lot of progress on kind of this one-by-one or this multilateral cooperation front, and they feel ready to move in the from that other angle. And I think the most significant part about this story, and I really like the way the Financial Times piece that we have in the Trumpet Weekly brings this out, is that it is Germany that is doing this. They have some fantastic quotes about what this show says about Germany. They wrote that the tone reflects Germany's growing clout and confidence in pursuing a foreign policy backed by elements of hard power. It had some quotes from the report talking about, making just much more, taking a much more forceful stance on intervening militarily. They quote Jan Tekau, a former defense official at Carnegie Europe, saying, "This is the time of a new Germany. This is probably the first time a German defense white paper is something like important." And when you put all of those quotes in context with what this article doesn't talk about, which is these conversations that we've been having on this program in the past about this other side of Germany's efforts to build a military union, it tells you something very powerful about what Germany is doing today with this European army.
The segment that we have in our Trumpet Weekly, this is our weekly report that we offer freely to anyone who asks for it. You can find this on thetrumpet.com. But the geopolitical futures quote that we have in there that talks about a big part of the reason for Germany taking this approach is the pressure that the United States has been putting on Germany and on Europe generally to look after its own security needs. Like, they're pulling out, Europe has to step up, here's how Germany is responding. I thought that was a very interesting point.
I agree, and I also thought it was interesting the way that they brought out that this might be a new military alliance. So it's, in some ways, it's an alternative to NATO. Now, we could see that absorbed into the NATO structure, but this is a new way of Europe organizing its military, and it does not have the United States involved. And you'd have thought that's something that that the United States would be worried about, but this is exactly what Mr. Obama wants. It's especially what Donald Trump wants, and he talks about some of Donald Trump's comments about NATO being obsolete. And so basically Europe is saying, okay, NATO's obsolete, let's build our own alliance without you.
One question that came to mind in reading this story was, I wonder who leaked this report. I think the timing is interesting. It was the Financial Times piece that highlighted just how the release of this information could really influence the Brexit referendum, and just how much opposition there is to a unified European army within Britain, and this could actually influence the vote. It just made me wonder who was behind the leak. Do we have any idea?
I certainly don't, but I agree that the timing is very interesting, especially as it brings out that the report was originally scheduled to be published before June 23rd, and then the German government delayed publication until after June 23rd. So it seems like the authors of this report and the German government were very aware that this could play a role within the Brexit referendum and deliberately delayed it. And it also raises the question, is there anything else that the EU is putting off until after that referendum?
Well, it will be interesting to see how this influences Britain's decision on whether or not to stay in the EU. The amount of evidence there is that the anti-EU argument is trying to make, that side trying to get Britain out, they have a whole lot on their side that's turning the British people away from the European project. But this is interesting to see what Germany is going to do if they're able to implement this. This is obviously something that they've been desiring for a long time and haven't necessarily had a whole lot of success, certainly from the top down, the way that you mentioned. We'll be watching to see whether that changes. Well, thanks for that report, Richard. Another part of the world that is looking to militarize is Japan. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been working for quite some time to change his nation's pacifist constitution, and this trend took an interesting turn this week. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, the government there under Mr. Abe has stressed this week that their nation's constitution does not ban them from having nuclear weapons. That was a statement made on Wednesday. It was in response to a lawmaker's inquiry about the Constitution, and the government basically said that if they wanted to, they could both build and use nuclear weapons. So it's really significant because ever since the end of World War II, after Japan had allied with Nazi Germany and really brutally tried to take over Asia, the Japanese have had a pacifist clause in their constitution. It's called Article 9, and it has forbade them from engaging in war and really limited the country to being a pacifist nation. And part of that constitution has expressly forbidden Japan from having a traditional military and offensive weapons. But recently, as you said, Article 9 has been under attack by a lot of the more hawkish elements in the Japanese government. They want to do away with all this pacifism and turn Japan into a full-fledged military nation once again. And really, it's hard to blame them for wanting to do that. On one hand, you have China rising up, becoming more and more aggressive and just bullying a lot of the nations in the region, Japan and other smaller nations. And then on the other hand, you have the United States, which has been Japan's guarantor of security since the end of World War II. But now it's increasingly clear that the United States is a broken power that can't really be relied upon for those security measures. So those in Japan who are working to reinterpret Article 9 and just to make Japan a capable military power really do have good reason to be thinking the way they've been thinking. And in 2014, they had a major victory when they reinterpreted that clause in order to allow the Japanese Self-Defense Force to become more assertive and specifically to deploy in order to help friendly nations that are under attack. And now you have members of the Japanese government saying Japan can have and use a nuclear arsenal. So those who have studied Japan's wartime history would know that that's really alarming, mostly because of how fiercely determined the Japanese become when they get involved in military conflicts. That determination in the past has made them capable of great ruthlessness and just of having no limits on what they will do in order to try to secure a victory. If it's in their power to take a certain action to further Japan's standing in a conflict, then they will take that action. That was the lesson during World War II. And so if nuclear weapons are entered into the equation and become a part of Japan's arsenal, and then if Japan were to become involved in a conflict once again, it's very easy, I think, to envision a scenario in which they would use those cataclysmically destructive weapons. The government did clarify that even though their constitution does not forbid them from having nuclear weapons, that they still maintain a nuclear-free policy for the time being. So it's not like they're saying it's time for us to start to develop these. But these kinds of statements and trends are still very significant, I think, and worth keeping our eye on for sure.
And Japan could attain that capability very quickly. They're certainly have a robust nuclear program, and to turn energy production into weaponization wouldn't be that difficult for them.
That's right. They're always on the cutting edge of technology. The Japanese are incredibly skilled at those sorts of things. So if they did decide to, I think it would not take long at all for them to have a pretty viable and robust program.
Of course, we keep our eyes on Asia, on the nations and the major nations, the industrialized nations within Asia in particular, because of this Asian alliance that we're watching for. And we do watch the increase of arms, defense spending, military spending within Asia closely because of just how much this Asian alliance factors into biblical prophecy in terms of its contribution to a worldwide conflagration. So the introduction of nuclear weapons into Japan really could play a significant factor into the fulfillment of that prophecy. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to look at Iran now. Just this past Wednesday, the deputy commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard said that if the United States and its allies threaten the Islamic Republic, then Iran will shut down the strategic gate of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz. Just the latest in a series of provocations by Iran. This is the nation that we were supposed to have good relations with after striking that nuclear deal, and that was implemented just this past January. Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal wrote an article this week. It's in this week's Trumpet Weekly. talking about the nation of Oman and its part in helping Iran. For this story, we'll go to Jerusalem and straight to the author himself, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look at the provocations that Iran has laid out this week in reference to the Straits of Hormuz, because they are the dominant nation there. The narrowest points of the straits, about 21 miles wide, and not all of that can you traverse or sail through, I guess, with a large oil tanker. There's only certain parts that you can of that 21 miles. And the region that you can travel through actually is in Omani territorial waters, not Iranian. So we've seen of late, ever since the nuclear deal, a desire of Iran to show that it's not weakening its stance or its push to be a dominant player in the world, and it's only increased that. And we see that through this region here of the Straits of Hormuz, and even particularly in the relationship that it's fostering with the nation on the other side of the straits, that being Oman. Now, there has been a number of details over the past 6 or 7 months leading up to the implementation of the nuclear deal and then thereafter, which has led a lot of commentators to see the relationship between Oman and Iran strengthening. A number of different trade deals have been worked out. There is a going forward a decision to construct a large liquefied natural gas pipeline that will go underneath the Straits of Hormuz, and that would be then produced inside Oman, between Iran and Oman, and then that would be shipped out to the world. There's Iran back in March. They offered that they were going to establish a $200 million joint venture with Oman to have a car company, automobile plant developed in Oman as well, with their largest automobile carrier or creator as well. And production is set to start for that just in 2017. And then also the Oman's largest lender, the Bank of Muscat, that was approved to open a branch in Tehran recently following the opening of the financial system of Iran to the world. So there are a number of indications that Oman is becoming closer with Iran, and it's something that we definitely expect to flourish going forward.
And this really could cement Iran's control over that very strategic seagate.
Sure thing. If they now, they could probably put a stop to the Straits of Hormuz without Oman's willing help along with it. But it certainly does make sense for them to develop a closer relationship with the nation on the other side of the strait. We do have the U.S. Fifth Fleet, I believe it is, that's stationed in Bahrain inside the Persian Gulf. So whether the Americans would allow them to shut the straits or not, or whether Iran is just testing to see whether they would or not. We know what happened a month or two ago with some of American soldiers that were taken in by the Iranians in the Persian Gulf. So maybe they're trying to see whether the United States will react or not. But just looking at Oman for the time being, it is a very interesting country that, even though it's on the Persian Gulf and it's part of the Gulf Cooperation Council with Saudi, led by Saudi Arabia, its natural inclination is to be more of an ally with Iran rather than the GCC. It's got a totally separate religion than Shia and Sunni, or it is not totally separate, I guess. It's a Muslim or Islamic religion. The Abadi sect is what is the majority there in Oman. And so there isn't necessarily a religious desire to be friends with Iran over the Saudis, but it just seems like there is more in common with the Iranians. And given that they are so close to Iran, that trade could flourish in the, between the two more so than it has between the Saudis and Oman.
How much would this be considered a provocation by Saudi Arabia? Here, they're already the Iranians have established quite a presence in Yemen and exerted quite a bit of control over that country, which borders both Saudi Arabia and Oman. And here, it's really the entire southern part of the Arabian Peninsula that Iran would be getting a bit of a hold over. It seems like Saudi Arabia would really consider itself surrounded.
Yeah, the Saudis are upset with this, definitely. Even going back to events earlier this year when the Saudis executed the Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr, and the response of that was in Tehran, the Saudi Arabian embassy got overrun by Iranians. They let that happen. And then you had a cascade of Sunni groups or Sunni countries that cut off relations with, including all the other GCC states, cut off relations with Tehran, diplomatic relations, but Oman didn't. And that was probably one of the initial signs that they were warming to Iran. I mean, why would they cut Iran off? They're key to greater economic wealth going forward. Now, I would say also that Oman is a different kettle of fish compared to the different states in the Middle East. They have a policy of being somewhat more, kind of like Turkey's policy was to be friends with everyone and enemies of no one at the same time. They don't like creating enemies. Even during the Iran-Iraq war back in 1980, they chose not to take sides in that war so that not to... they're only a small state and they don't want to create too many enemies. So there are some people that are cautioning the article or thoughts like the article that I've read that Iran is trying to grow in power in Oman just because Oman has been open to different relationships in the past. And yet it is coming. The strengthening relationship is coming at the precise time that Iran is extending its influence throughout the Middle East and into Africa. And naturally, Oman would be a great stepping stone for them into Africa and even controlling the waterway, like you say, around the Persian Gulf and then into Yemen. So it is definitely something I think is worth watching. And if the economies of Oman and Iran get so integrated, it is the Omanis that are going to have to answer to the Iranians more than the other way around. Oman has 4 million people. Iran has 80 million people. Iran has a GDP of around $900 billion a year. The GDP of of Oman is a lot smaller than that, maybe a couple percentage points of that. So in the end, they're going to have to play little brother to Iran. And the fact that they're integrating their economy so much, it should worry the Omanis just in case Iran decides not to be so friendly.
Iran is definitely a nation that is not standing still. It's always fascinating to track its movements. We're going to come back to that in the second segment. But I'm sure that this is something that Europe is taking note of as Iran continues to cement its position as the powerhouse in that region. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break, a fire in Canada that has some wider implications. And for this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, well, for 3 days, there's been just this massive wildfire in Fort McMurray, Canada. I believe it's... caused the biggest mass evacuation in Alberta's history due to wildfire. They've had almost 90,000 people, pretty much the entire city, have to leave. So far, I think it's burned down around 40 square miles, or there'd be about 100 square kilometers for our Canadian audience. A lot of them are using like the oil camps up there for as almost like refugee centers to try to get people, but as they're trying to either fly them or bus them into down into like Edmonton or other surrounding areas. But yeah, it's really just a huge humanitarian crisis there to have an entire city like that evacuated. And it has some more long range implications for the oil industry as well. Being that that's right, the major center for the Canadian tar sands.
Yeah, you put it in the context of we just have a little blurb in the Trumpet Weekly about Libyan oil supplies being threatened and other pressures on Canada's oil supply, and this really could have long-ranging economic implications.
Right. There is almost like a civil war in Libya right now between Eastern and Western factions, which is causing their oil production to plummet. But this, with Fort McMurray going down, and now they're using the the camps that they normally have the oil workers live at for refugees from the city, but they're estimating that for in the next few months, it could have their oil production decline by about 1 million barrels a day, which will definitely bring the price of crude petroleum up a few dollars a barrel at least.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about an outside nation waging war in Africa. We'll talk about the rise of fascism in Croatia, how Russia is responding to Europe, responding to Russia, and London's new Muslim mayor. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We were talking earlier about Iran's involvement with Oman, and we're going to take another look at what Iran is doing, this time in Africa. Some developments to keep our eyes on in this region, this continent, that relate to biblical prophecy. And to tell us about this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent.
Yeah, this is a story I received. I think it was from Jeremiah that emailed me this, and it's by the blog warisboring.com. And while it's a funny title for a blog, they are a legitimate commentator on different affairs, such as, you know, troop movements and different geopolitical affairs. And they have written an article that's in the Trumpet Weekly entitled "Iran's Other Shadow War in Africa." And it's quite good. It details a number of different arenas and countries where Iran is trying to infiltrate. It talks about, of course, the fact that there have been a lot of weapons caches that have been found en route to Yemen inside the Red Sea there. But then it focuses on a number of nations, most notably Sudan. Now, Sudan occupies the western side of the Red Sea, so it's quite a strategic area. There's some large ports there as well on the Red Sea. And it talks about how, well, it's been long known that Iran has been involved in Sudan, but it talks about a number of activities where they've trained Sudanese army's officials. Iranian missiles have been video documented as well, being used by Sudan's central government against the Sudanese rebels in the south. There's even been Iranian fighter jets that have bombed inside South Sudan as well. So it talks about Sudan, this article, and then it goes on and talks about how in Kenya as well, back in November 2015, just last year, Kenyan authorities, they arrested a number of Iranian assets that were trying to blow up different Western targets in the country. And then it also focuses on Nigeria and how that Iran is trying to destabilize the government there inside Nigeria by bolstering the Shia opposition. And then also it discusses how in Nigeria you have a number of different operatives that have been caught receiving training and weapons from Iran as well. And then it also talks about Kenya and how Iran looks to be moving in there. So it's a quite interesting article. I would suggest that people read it just because of that fact. It shows how Iran's hands, as you said earlier, they're not just happy with containing themselves to Iran. They really want to increase their dominance, not just through the Middle East, but heading into Africa as well.
It's very interesting. I'm just wondering, what is Iran trying to accomplish? You know, you look at a nation like Sudan, and it's obviously right there on the Red Sea. It would be a part that territory that Iran would be really interested in if it's trying to control that Red Sea trade route. But going down deeper into the sub-Saharan Africa, it does make me wonder what Iran's plans would be.
Right. It certainly looks like Iran, I mean, people naturally think that Iran, as it pushes for dominance through Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, even Oman, as we talked about earlier, that they might be content with the Middle East. But there is a large Muslim population, a lot of them radicals, though they are mostly Sunni, coming through Central Africa, all the way from Sudan, all the way across to West Africa. You can see that Iran is vying for leadership of those Islamic terrorist groups. And as we've even talked about again on this program, they probably wouldn't settle with that as well. So as they grow in power across Central Africa, you know that they're going to want to push north towards Mali and into Libya. And that's where we do expect a face-off is going to take place with Europe.
The story that we have in the Trumpet Weekly about this, I think it has a really good conclusion in just putting this in its prophetic context. It quotes this chairman of the German Federal Armed Forces Association, Lieutenant Colonel André Wüstner, and he once said that terror in Africa makes it clear once again that a ring of fire extends from Afghanistan via Yemen, Syria, and Iraq to Africa. The statement is, this could well be the reason Europe, as the Bible prophesies, will unleash a whirlwind attack in the Middle East and Africa. Just looking at Iran's tentacles extending out so far, you can see that this nation, you know, it's easier to see the more you look into these kinds of activities that Iran is engaged in, why it would take such a violent attack in order to take it out. Well, thank you, Brent. We're going to go now to the Balkans and the nation of Croatia. This is a nation we've talked a lot about over the years, very strategically important. And to tell us about what is happening there, we'll go back to our office in the UK and Richard Palmer.
There has been a far-right surge in Croatia, to use the words of the agency France Press. But what is big and what is different about what is happening in Croatia is this isn't some fringe group that's getting a lot of vote. There is an astonishing amount of kind of sympathy with the far right that is being encouraged by the government and by cabinet ministers. Now, during World War II, Croatia was allied with Nazi Germany. It was ruled by a group known as the Ustashi or Ustasha, and they were horribly brutal, every bit as bad as the Nazis, if not worse. 750,000 Serbs were killed in just 4 years, and they were killed often in very brutal ways, you know, ripped apart limb from limb, cut open and have their organs extracted one at a time while still alive. And these kind of things, they were performed on women, they were performed on children. So these are some horrible, horrible people that were doing this. But now the government is building these people back up, this Ustashi, praising them as Croatian heroes. And there is this widespread revival of these leaders. This article talks about, it quotes a historian talking about how the downplaying of these atrocities has existed for years, but in a different intensity. It has now penetrated cabinet ministers and the mainstream media. And the article talks about how their modern sympathizers see these people who cut open women and children as the country's founding fathers. So it's a really sobering development there from Croatia.
So put this in context for us in terms of why this would be so concerning within Croatia. Obviously, a strong ally of Germany in World War II, and we've talked about in our booklet, The Rising Beast, about German in relationship with Croatia being important in modern times. Why would this be so concerning for us in that context?
Well, there's still a huge amount of hatred within the Balkans. There's been a lot of bad blood. There's been all these atrocities committed against the Serbs. The Croatians, they have a whole bunch of their grievances going back hundreds of years that they say the Serbs have done to them. Then there's a whole bunch of other groups. So there is a lot of dry wood there that could burst out in flames. And just to give an example of how of some of the inflammatory comments that have been thrown around here, there was a local television journalist who was on TV telling especially mothers and children to be careful while walking near a Serb Orthodox church because the priests might come and kill them. And so given all of that background and mistrust between these different ethnic groups, between the different religions, because there's a very strong religious element here, there's the potential to spark violence, to spark persecution. It wouldn't be a stretch at all for that to happen.
And just remind us, Croatia's status with respect to EU membership.
Right. Croatia is the most recent nation to join the European Union. They joined in 2013. They're one of a couple of nations from the Balkans that have become, or at least from the former Yugoslavia, that have joined the European Union. So this is a nation that's supposed to have very tolerant, liberal, Western-style values. And you're getting this kind of intimidation and resurrection of a Nazi past from.
Really interesting when viewed in the context of this trend that we're tracking across Europe, the rise in far-right parties, anti-immigration parties. This is probably one of the most extreme of that trend that we see in Europe. We have a center spread in our coming issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine that tracks just how much this type of thing is happening, changing the political scene in Europe right across the board. And when viewed in that context, we really see this as part of that broader trend. Well, thanks for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review. I think that you could make a strong case that one of the most dynamic and important relationships to watch in the time ahead is that between Europe and Russia. There are specific biblical prophecies that speak to this and that show why it's so important. In this week's Trumpet Weekly, we have a story about some moves that Russia is making in response to Europe that are very concerning. And for this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, we were just in the Balkans for that last story, and now we'll head up to the similar-sounding Baltics, just across the border from the Baltics in the far west of Russia, where Russia is creating three brand-new military divisions with the specific purpose of countering NATO. NATO, of course, is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, includes most of the European countries and also the U.S. and Canada, and NATO has been working on plans to expand into those Baltic nations, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and also into Poland. And NATO has said it will post a rotational ground force of about 4,000 troops in these nations, which are right on Russia's border for the most part. And this rotational force would be in addition to an armored brigade of 4,200 troops that America has decided to station there starting next February. So it's a pretty significant buildup by NATO and U.S. forces, and Russia is not happy about it. The buildup is clearly designed to be sort of able to prevent Russia from doing what it has done in Ukraine over the last couple of years, prying territory away and destabilizing a lot of the nation in kind of a frozen conflict. And NATO has said over and over that this buildup there in the Baltics is strictly for defensive reasons. But Russia either doesn't believe that, or they just don't appreciate this kind of preemptive, preventative measure. So Russian President Vladimir Putin is creating these three new divisions. Combined, they would represent about 30,000 troops. And this will reinforce Russia's western and southern flanks quite a bit. We still don't know whether these new divisions will be created from scratch, or if they will be made from existing Russian military forces, just sort of restructured and reassigned. But the aim is for them to be operational by the end of this year. And it's interesting to me that NATO and the U.S. are planning to put some 8,000 troops in the Baltics there. And in response, Russia is putting 30,000 troops there. So that's pretty disproportionate. And it just seems like it's going to prevent Poland and the Baltics from being comforted very much by those efforts by NATO and America. They will just see that as a little bit too little to be of much use against these brand new three gigantic Russian divisions. So I just think that it could make these Eastern European nations warm even more to the idea of a united European military capable of defending them from this increasing Russian threat.
Yeah, so many signs of just how jittery, how frightened those Eastern European nations are in light of Russia's advance in Ukraine, in Crimea. And it's really interesting to watch this here. Europe is putting those troops there in response to that aggression and trying to defend themselves. Russia comes back with even stronger, as you said, disproportionate response. And it's not difficult at all to see how Europe would feel all the more compelled to respond with even greater force. And we know that conflict is coming between these two. They talk about accommodation, and we have a certain amount of discussion going on between Russian and German politicians and so on. When it's all said and done, though, these two powers are not going to be friends.
It looks like a lot of serious tensions are really building there.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to conclude with some crazy news out of Britain. Actually, kind of a collection of stories that show everything's kind of going off the rails over here. For this, we're going to turn to Andrew.
Right. It is a bit of a collection of stories we have, mainly, and just craziness in Britain's Labour Party. I know it's kind of a funny quote from a former British Chancellor, Margaret Thatcher, when they asked her what her greatest victory was in office, and she said, well, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, basically saying that these are two prominent Labour leaders from just a few years ago who'd adopted her free market reforms. So I said, well, the Labour Party is definitely, after Gordon Brown's was ousted and Jeremy Corbyn's taken his place as the Labour leader, gone, scratched those free market Thatcherite reforms they got and gone all the way back to, like, far left democratic socialism. Even some of these stories, I mean, we're getting more introduced to democratic socialism here in America through Bernie Sanders, but some of these policies even make him look sane.
But so what are some of the what's happening? We have these protests. You wrote this article about these anti-capitalists that are kind of getting louder and louder against the capitalist policies.
Right. Well, because last Sunday was May Day, which, if you don't know, it's like a communist, almost like a communist holiday. It was made like the anniversary of some protest, violent communist protest they had in Chicago in 1886. And so throughout Soviet times, they celebrated it with big military parades every year. Now in more capitalist nations, it's usually a day where for people to get out there and riot against capitalist policies. So they had a big rally in London with all these people. They had their red flags with the hammer and sickle on them, and they had their posters of Joseph Stalin and all that, which not uncommon. It pretty much happens every May Day in London. But this year, what was interesting, for the first time in 50 years, a leader of the Labour Party decided it was a good idea to go out and talk to these people. So this is Jeremy Corbyn. He'd gone out there, and so he's got all these posters of Stalin and communist flags surrounding him, and he figured this would be a good time to talk about the dangers of the far right in Europe. And, I mean, Richard just talked about some of those dangers of the far right in Europe, so not necessarily a bad message, but his point didn't come across like it should when you're surrounded by posters of Stalin and communist flags.
He's not lecturing them about the dangers of communism.
Right. So it's you'd think that would have been and horrible timing, because it was just last year he had appointed a new directors of communication for the Labour Party who was a Stalin apologist. They'd written an article for The Guardian magazine on how the claim that Stalin killed 30 million people is nonsense, and he only killed 3 million people, so that makes it all better somehow. But just trying to make it into, he said, hey, I don't want this. This new director of communications was saying, he said it's bad that people equate Stalin and Hitler as equally bad. They said if Stalin only killed 3 million people, then that means he's only half as bad as Hitler, I guess.
But they're still speaking of it as if they're defending him from an ideological standpoint, and there are people that are still talking about communism as if it's ideologically sound. You know, throw out the fact that it's produced dictators and that it's, you know, that you've had pogroms that have killed multiple millions of people.
Right.
It seems like what's happening in London, this is really of a piece with what you see happening so much in the United States. I mean, we had May Day parades here that even turned violent, similar to what happened in London. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders and just the arousal of excitement among the young, especially, who are espousing more and more of these very radical communist rooted ideals. This is, you know, America and Britain are really partners in this trend.
Right, because Sanders has spoken favorably of like Castro and Gorbachev in the past, and that, but there is really a movement where for like Stalin and Lenin, they'll distance themselves from them, but they don't attack their ideology. They just attack them as like a good idea poorly carried out, or these were just bad people who didn't stick to the policies of true socialism or true communism. It said if you could get a good guy to implement it, it said it'd be worth another go round.
And of, I guess, more evidence of just how unhinged so many of the people in Britain are becoming, London has a new mayor.
Right. Well, Richard would probably be able to maybe give me a closer update on this. Just before the show, I looked, it looked like they were still counting the votes. But they have a new, looks like the candidate was ahead with Sadiq Khan, which would definitely be a Labour Party member who would be the first Muslim mayor ever for London.
Any update, Richard?
I don't have the final quote or the final stat count at all, but it is part of a long-term position where the Labour Party has tried to reach out to Muslim voters and get support from Muslim voters, and also try and get support from Muslims that are kind of on the borders of being extreme, you know, on that end of the spectrum. Labour candidates will speak at rallies where the audience is segregated into men and women. Both Sadiq Khan and Ken Livingstone, who was the previous London mayor, had links to some quite questionable, or had spoken alongside some quite questionable Muslims. For example, Sadiq Khan, he's attended a rally hosted by Friends of the Alaska Mosque called Palestine, The Suffering Still Goes On, and shared a platform there. And he shared a platform quite a few times with a Muslim who's now been identified as a supporter of the Islamic State. Now, I don't think Sadiq Khan for a minute is a supporter of the Islamic State, but I think he certainly wouldn't mind getting the vote of people who look sympathetically on the Islamic State. And that's something you see from the left across Britain. And one thing I'll just mention quickly on Jeremy Corbyn is he did just get quite the beating in the polls today. The Labour Party is now in third place in Scotland, for example, their worst results ever. At this point in an election cycle, you'd expect them to be doing really well. So plainly, his views do not have a lot of support within Britain. But I mean, we're just one economic crisis away from that support swinging around. And even 5-10 years ago, it would be unimaginable to have someone of his views as the leader of the Labour Party.
Well, watching this unfold in Britain, it seems similar in some ways to what's happening in the United States, where you just have this increasing fractioning of the electorate and people becoming more deeply entrenched in more extreme views and pitting against one another in opposition, where it's just very difficult to make sense of the political scene.
Right. I was actually just one comment I think I'll throw in here on Sadiq Khan before I address that as the other unsettling thing that I'd just seen this morning is a 2009 interview he gave on to an Iranian TV channel where they'd actually questioned him about some of those like extremist rallies he'd attended to earlier, some of these extremists he'd spoken with. And this was the quote he said. He said, "The point is you can't just pick and choose who you speak to. You can't just speak to Uncle Tom's," which there's a bit of a backlash to that because, I mean, you'll know that Uncle Tom is from the Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's a derogatory term for, like, black Americans who supported their white slave masters back before the Civil War. So now he's Kent's come out, and after the backlash, he's Kent's come out and apologized for that, for being using a racist term that might offend African Americans. But he still hasn't addressed the interesting question is, like, is that really how you view the moderate Islamic people in Britain? You think these are, like, race traitors? These are Uncle Toms? They say, well, I'll have to talk to both sides. I can't just talk to the Uncle Toms who've betrayed their race. I have to talk to the extremists too sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think the other part of that story is he himself, before that video emerged, if I got the story correctly, had condemned people who called people Uncle Toms. So an interesting talking out of both sides of his mouth there.
Well, the Islamization of Britain continues apace, definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on going forward. Thank you for that, Andrew. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. We'd like to encourage you to go there to get a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we talk about on this program, we pack them into this weekly report. We ship it out every Friday via email to your inbox, and it's absolutely free. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
A new poll published this week by the Bild newspaper found that 60% of people in Germany say there is no place for Islam in their country. That's a dramatic shift compared to other polls. This same week, the Alternative for Deutschland, the fringe right-wing German party, they agreed a new anti-Islam position where they called for a ban on minarets at mosques, a ban on full face veils, a ban on female headscarves in schools, for example. And they booed and rejected a similar plan, rejecting it as too soft, that merely called on stopping Islamism but seeking dialogue with Islam. Now, from those two pieces of news, it's no surprise that the AfD is now the third most popular party in Germany. So their support is growing as they adopt this anti-Islam rhetoric.
All right, now over to Andrew.
A U.S. aircraft carrier was denied access to the port of Hong Kong this week by the Chinese government. Just a kind of a major slap to the U.S. Navy in the South China Sea, especially considering that the port of Hong Kong was a British port up until just 1997 when the British gifted it back to the Chinese government.
All right, we'll go now to Jeremiah.
In the time that Vladimir Putin has been at the helm of Russia, the country has built more mega bridges than in its entire prior history. So Putin has built more of these bridges than all other Russian leaders combined throughout history. Of the 25 longest ones in Russia, 16 were built in 2000 or more recently, so that's since Putin came into office. And the combined length of all of his bridges is more than 24 miles. So it's just one reason why we can see how he's so popular among his people.
All right, we'll send it over to Brent now.
Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu has resigned amid a growing rift with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and this has created a lot of concern in the EU over the EU-Turkey deal on refugees, whereby Turkey was going to close off the border to refugees coming across and to house them inside Turkey's borders. And to on the other end of this, they were going to receive some visa-free travel for Turkish citizens. That looks like it might come to, it might be happening. And Davutoğlu, he was the main architect of parts of this deal, and he was viewed by liberal leaders in Europe as being somebody that they can work with more than Erdogan. Now they're worried that now that Davutoğlu has gone, the voice that was moderating Erdogan is going to get even stronger.
And now to Richard.
The EU has taken a big step towards offering Turkey visa-free travel. They're overlooking quite a few of their own rules to do this. They have imposed some conditions on Turkey, and it also needs to be approved by the European Parliament and by member states, so it may well not go forward. However, it shows the EU continuing to pander to Turkey in the hope that Turkey will help them deal with the migrant crisis.
Now to Andrew.
The United States just set a new record for firearm sales in April. This actually, the Federal Bureau of Investigation ran over 2 million background checks for that month, making it the 12th straight month of record gun sales. Seems to be one of the one and only major areas of the economy that's been stimulated under the Obama administration is for the past 8 years, private firearms stock and sales have been booming.
And we'll finish with Jeremiah.
A famous Russian orchestra held a big concert in the liberated city of Palmyra, there in Syria. It was the renowned St. Petersburg Mariinsky Orchestra, and they played on Thursday. They played in the same ancient Roman theater that Islamic State terrorists had recently used to execute Syrian soldiers inside of. Most of those executions took place back in November, but the Islamic State is no longer in possession of Palmyra. The Russians and Syrians have routed them from that area. Now it's firmly in control of the Syrian government, so this was kind of just a big major victory concert of sorts by the Russians.
Well, thanks for that. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com, and we will give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we talk about on the program are in this week's edition. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Aristotle. The worst form of inequality is to try to make unequal things equal. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.